perfect supper beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some movie clips of popcorn fighting fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxing, school month or movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contests and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slogan, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. With the other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today I've got a great episode for you. I've got a wonderful question from Merc the Meek about Osric versus AD&D and OSE versus BX. And I reached out to some other people to help answer this question. I've got some great answers about, you know, somebody that doesn't have nostalgia for these things, what system should they pick? So you've got that question. You've got answers from a number of people to that question. So that's what you have to look forward to today. In addition to that, after the ending credits, I'm going to give you my spoiler-filled review of Season 4 of True Detective, Night Country. Again, that's after the end credits. So if you haven't seen True Detective Season 4, you don't care about that, once you hear the ending music, you can turn the episode off. You're not going to miss anything. If you're curious about it, then stay after the credits, but I do spoil it.
Okay, a lightning round of podcast endorsements, and this is from the car, so I apologize for background noise. Shadow the GM podcast is no more. GM Shadow has moved over to Acast and has now launched A Song of Dice and Shadows, and they're going to be doing some solo play, doing different explorations of different things, using Beck, me, and no doubt GURPS and things like that. So check that out. There's a link in the show notes, and the RSS feed is in the show notes, so you can add it to your own podcatcher. Jules over at Jules from NZ has done a great episode talking about how to plot a campaign or how to plot a story-based adventure to a fixed number of sessions. You know, these days, a lot of people aren't just doing random adventures where the adventures are wandering around and you're just reacting to what they're doing. They have set plots. And if you're doing one of these kind of adventures and you only have X number of sessions to run it in, how do you make sure it fits in that number of sessions? Well, Jules has a bunch of tips on that. It's really good information, really good advice. Kind of comes down to kill your darlings, right? But it's great stuff. Go listen to Jules. You should be listening to her anyway. So the link to that is in the show notes. Last podcast, well, two more podcasts I'm going to mention. One is Merc the Meek is now going to do a watch along with me and discuss Delicious in Dungeon. So if that sounds interesting to you, go check out Merc the Meek Show. There's a link in the show notes. Delicious in Dungeon is an anime where a delving party, it's like D&D, they're going in the dungeon and instead of taking food with them, they're eating what they find in the dungeon. Last thing I want to mention is over at the Glitter Boys podcast, which is my favorite Palladium-based podcast, discussion podcast about Palladium stuff. My favorite actual Palladium podcast, without a doubt, of course, is Real Play Games podcast. But there's a link to them in the show notes as well. But the Glitter Boys recently had Kevin from Palladium Books on there. And they talked about his early years, how he got into the industry, and the early years of Palladium Books up until when before Palladium Fantasy was published. So really great interview, really interesting. Go check it out. Link to that in the show notes. And, you know, the Glitter Boys is a great show anyway, so I highly recommend it. Quick insert here before I end the lightning round. One last thing. On the YouTube channel Grail Country, and I don't watch that channel,
normally. I don't know anything about it, but there's about an hour-long interview with James Raggy of Lamentations of the Flame Princes. And you might be thinking, I hate that guy. But you know what? He's a normal guy like everybody else. And this is kind of his origin story. And him just talking about philosophy and his gaming. Not so much his philosophy, well, his philosophy about games, but also his upbringing. And it's really interesting insight into somebody that has been almost universally hated by the community. And they've tried to force out of the community. So, you know, before you judge him too harshly, maybe go listen to a story. I don't know. I don't like a lot of the Lamentations modules. I think Lamentations is a great version of BX. I understand why people do like them, the whole shock jock thing, all that kind of thing. And that's fine. If you like the splatterpunk thing and the in-your-face, really edgy thing, then they're out there. And I think there's a place for them on the market, and I don't think we should try to ban them or get them off the market. It's like when, in the early days of the OSR, McKinney published Carcosa. This is before Lamentations published Carcosa. And there was a big rift in the OSR about Carcosa, whether it deserved to exist and whether it should be part of the OSR and whether the OSR needed to distance itself from this vile product, right? And, you know, I've always got the inclination to defend publishers in those cases, depending what's being published. It doesn't mean it's necessarily what I would use at my table, but I don't see why it shouldn't be on the market. And we'll have different views on that, and that's fine. And you don't need to call in and say why things should be banned from the market. If you do, depending if you get political or not, I may or may not play the messages. But point being, no doubt you've heard things about Lamentations of the Flame Princess James Raggy, but do you know James Raggy's backstory? Maybe you don't care. I don't know. But I thought it was interesting. So I'm going to include a link to that interview in the show notes as well.
Okay, that's it for the lightning round. Now I've got a ton of great calls, so let's go to those calls.
Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Well, maybe it's your auntie or a joke by your spouse, but the operator's scream is coming from inside the house.
Hey Jason, it's Anthony calling in from the very rainy highway and windy, being buffeted left and right. So I'm just calling in to say, you know, to give my appreciation for your look at the Warriors with M.W. Lewis. I really enjoyed it because I have both seen and not seen the Warriors, and I was kind of hesitant thinking about spoilers, but then I went for it. Let me explain. How could I have seen and yet not seen the Warriors? Well, I took a trip to China a number of years ago, and being blessed or cursed with insomnia, I found myself awake with nothing to do in a hotel in a city with a curfew, you know, and really no English channels. So while surfing through, I found the Warriors, which was just beginning. Of course, it was dubbed into Chinese, and the incongruity of that kept me going as I'm trying to figure out and follow along what's happening. And that was pretty entertaining, and I made it through to the end, and I thought, I really should watch this someday. And immediately after it was a really in-depth documentary on Chinese art called Bagua or Bagua Zhang, which of course is much more interesting to refer to as eight trigrams palm. But so I watched that, and then it was dawn. I was allowed to leave the hotel, so that I went out and found a bridge under which people were practicing, you know, elderly people were practicing various martial arts, and so I was practicing my martial arts and they were practicing their martial arts. And I was thinking about this documentary that I just watched, and I ended up having a pretty cool conversation, mostly in pantomime, about martial arts. And it's one of my favorite travel memories in Asia. And I owe it all to the Warriors. So, anyway, thanks again for explaining to me what actually happened and who everybody was in the movie. Take care.
Thank you so much for that call. Of course, that was Anthony, also known as Runeslinger, from the Casting Shadows blog and podcast and the Runeslinger YouTube channel. That's so funny. Thank you so much. I admit my ignorance when it comes to China, but I could see the Warriors being shown in, say, a Taiwan TV channel, but it would surprises me it'd be on a communist Chinese TV channel. I wonder if they edited it. So we're covering Water Hill movies all year this year, and although it hasn't been published yet, the episode for Southern Comfort's already been recorded. And Southern Comfort, which was released in the U.S. in 81, was released in the late 80s on Iranian TV as a different movie called Operation Lagoon. And they re-edited the movie to make it so the U.S. government was behind the soldiers being killed and to cover things up. And basically, it was it turned into a super anti-American film. And it was loved over there for this, really popular over there. And of course, you know, we were at odds with Iran for, you know, years before that, going back to the Iranian hostage crisis and whatnot. But it's funny. I wonder if communist China edited the Warriors at all and changed the dialogue or changed the, you know, how the movie was set up. That's curious to me. Thank you again so much for that call. And folks, go check out Anthony's various offerings.
Hey, Jason, just out on a walk right now, but wanted to call and let you know that earlier today I read the latest episode of your blog post, and I'm not going to give any major spoilers here, but I do want to say, folks, if you haven't been reading it, you need to. Jason is doing an amazing job of putting it together with awesome writing skills. It's fantastic. The only minor spoiler I will give is I was really, really, really rooting hard for the halfling glove maker. I was pulling hard for him. But Jason, you had amazing lines for whenever if anybody died. You had awesome sort of like little one-liners that were just, they were just perfect, man. So congratulations on that. I hope you keep it up. And yeah, folks, seriously, if you're not reading the blog posts, check it out. Anyway, dude, peace out.
Joe, thank you so much for those kind words. I don't think I'm a very good writer, to be honest with you. So, if you want to check my blog out, there's a link in the show notes. I've been doing a solo play over there using Dungeon Crawl Classics. Basically, I'm using the TSR module AC3 to run is a Dungeon Crawl Classics funnel. And it's been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed it. But the the truth is, I do not consider myself an author, so don't go over there expecting wonderful prose. But if you're curious about it, go check it out. Links in the show notes. Thank you, Joe, for those kind words. I hope you enjoy what we're going to be doing next on the blog. Also, check out Joe's stuff over at the Hindsightless podcast. Okay, let's move on to our next caller. Actually, I probably need to set this up a little bit. This is Rob, also known as Minion, from Confessions of a Wee Timmer Spooshy. Great podcast, go listen to it. But in previous episodes here on this show, we had a series of calls talking about the thief and thief skills, primarily with Daniel of Bandit's Keep and EOTB from the Classic Adventuring Gaming podcast, talking back and forth about it, and EOTB called in talking about how AD&D is much more generous in how they interpret those skills than some of the other versions of D&D are. You'll have to go back to the old episodes to hear all that talk, but that is the conversation that Minion is talking about in this call.
Hey, Jason, this is Rob, also known as Minion of Confessions of a Wee Timmer Spooshy podcast. I'm calling in regarding the thief, AD&D thief. And I think it was EOTB responding to our Daniel of Bandit's Keep podcast. And what EOTB says in defense of the thief, I think makes a great deal of sense. I've read the MG many times, but you know, my brain is like a sieve, but it must have retained something, because I've certainly more and more I've been moving towards a thief that is able to do things usually without any problem, unless there is a meaning, unless there's a real risk, a dramatic danger of the thief being discovered, or the thief is under some kind of pressure where the role is not a simple display of skills, but rather something quite magnificent or special. So, all right. So basically what I do is, if it's not in combat, I'll let them do it. If it's not in combat and it's not a particularly difficult role or game-changing role, I'll let them do it. If it's something that's rather difficult under difficult circumstances, and that could include disarming a trap or picking a lock in a dungeon under certain circumstances, I'll make them roll for that, but otherwise, no. And if they fail that role, it just means, yeah, they've not displayed that high level of expertise, and rather they're just acting at ordinary person level. So if there's a dexterity role involved, then I'd allow them to do a dexterity role. Obviously, that's not a role directly from the AD&D first edition DMG, but something that could be derived from some of the adventures. If it's a surprise role, I'll let them have the surprise role then. So there's, I guess, it's like a hierarchy of abilities, and the thief with his thief skills or her thief skills is at the apex of that. Their skills, even if it's 15% or whatever, 20%, it's still a 20% chance of doing something that is exceptional. So I forget what even they call it now. Climb walls, we usually refer to, is often called scale sheer surfaces in some versions of the early D&D game. And I think that gives you a good idea of what the thief skill, climbing skill really means. So can ordinary people do thief-like things? Well, yes, they can, but not to the exceptional degree displayed by the thief class or other classes with those skills, such as assassins or monks. Anyway, I better shut up, but you get the idea. Yeah, I tend to allow characters to do things under normal circumstances because they, being first level characters or higher, they are experts in their skill area. And that's it really, yeah. So very good stuff. And thank you particularly to EOTB for pointing that out. And to Bandit's Keep, of course, for asking the questions in the first place, I suppose. Cheers.
Thank you so much for those thoughts. I appreciate that. I don't really have anything to add, so I'm just going to move on to our next caller, who actually is Daniel from the Bandit's Keep Media Empire. Daniel has a couple things to say, but when he's talking about Riverside, Spotify for Podcasters, who we publish under, some of us use to publish, is getting rid of the Anchor app. And they're switching to an app called Riverside. And I published in the week previous to this episode coming out, I published a couple test episodes, bonus episodes, where I just played around with the Riverside app a little bit. And Daniel mentions that in the call. So when he's talking about Riverside, that's what he's talking about. So let's, without further ado, give the mic over to Daniel.
Hey, Jason. Daniel from Bandit's Keep calling in about the Riverside episode with the MW. Sounded really good to me. And if you can do interviews and make it really simple, that's cool. The processing doesn't sound great as far as time, but I guess if it's uploading video, maybe it takes longer. I'd be curious to do a test where it's only audio, if that's even possible, because maybe that's all you need. Maybe you can video chat but only record the audio. I'm not really sure how that works. I think you can do that on Zencaster. Anyways, I thought it sounded good. I'll see if I can give it a shot with KR, maybe not this recording, but soon, to see how it works out for us, because we actually record pretty long segments, as we say, and then edit them down. So it'd be a matter of being able to record it like that, get the good clear audio, and then download it to be able to do the editing, because KR edits in different software. So Yeah, I'd be curious, you know, how it works out. I mean, obviously, the original Anchor was so good with the, you know, simple recording and the call-ins, and they just keep taking things away. But maybe this will be decent for a different kind of podcasting, I guess, more interviews and things. As to MW's questions, so changing the time for a single player. Again, I feel like the question was put out there in a more generic way, and I don't think my answer would have matched up with his, but based on his exact situation, it sounds like, yeah, if it's a regular player in a group with seven people and 1 week they're going to be late, yeah, you wouldn't necessarily change the whole game for them necessarily. I mean, it wouldn't hurt to ask, I suppose. But if, for instance, you had a group that you were playing with and somebody got a new job and the day they could play changed, you might want to change things. Again, it would be, I would poll the group. I don't think that any one person makes it, you have to change it either, because if suddenly the GM gets a job and can't play on Mondays, but that's the day everybody else plays, then somebody else can GM, right? I mean, it's not like it's not like you're irreplaceable no matter what job you have at the table. You're more irreplaceable because you're somebody's friend and they want to play with you. You know, I don't think that what you're doing matters. So whether it's a player or the GM, I don't think that would matter to me. There have been in certain situations where I've wanted to run certain games and I was running them for a player who really wanted to play them, where I have delayed when something came up, you know, and I just ran something else or had somebody else run something. But if it's a regular campaign and one of the players isn't there, we usually just move forward. I do the same thing MW does, I guess, and because I only give XP for what you do, right? So, like, if you're playing the game and, you know, if you miss a day, let's say, and then they get a bunch of treasure, you won't get experience points for that. So my players don't seem to mind. It's the way it is. It balances out in the end, really, especially in games like D&D where the XP doubles and stuff. You know, people catch up. They go, it's the difference is usually not that great. Early levels, I think, are a bigger deal. Insofar as, I think that was the, oh, the other thing was alignment. Insofar as alignment, I don't know. I mean, he said it was, you couldn't be neutral, but I feel like I try to be pretty neutral. I can't imagine wanting to play with a group that would mock or poke fun at people or try to kill player characters as GMs. I find that to be fine for the occasional one shot where you're just being goofy. But I think long term, that would not be something I would want to be part of. So does that make me in the good camp? I guess. Because, yeah, that would just be silly. I always think that's a funny thing because I don't know any system. I mean, again, I'm no expert of every system, but I think most role-playing games where there is a GM-style person running the game that creates the adventures, I think that they can eliminate player characters easily. So how is that a how is that an achievement as a GM to oh ha ha, I killed your character, oh okay, yeah, that was really tough. Yeah, I don't know, it seems weird, but again, that's not me, and people play different ways. I'm not saying bad, wrong, fun, but if you're being crappy to your friends, then I am saying that. And it doesn't sound like you were talking about that with the people you play with, but I wouldn't play at a table where people are trying to kill the player characters. I mean, there can be levity. I mean, I've definitely played in games where people, you know, where the characters get killed and it's funny and, you know, it's more of a loose, silly vibe. You know, I mean, The Hateful Place, almost every time we play, it's a TPK. And that's part of the game and everybody kind of enjoys that fun part. But in no way is the GM out to kill people. It just is, that's the nature of the game, right?
I'm going to break into the call here just to answer those 2 points. In one of the Riverside episodes I put out, I did a joint recording with MW from the Worlds of MW Lewis podcast, another fun AD&D podcast. And he asked, would you change the time of your regular session for one player? And I think for, you know, one single session of your game. And to me, I was thinking more, would you change it from, say, 7 p.m. to 7:30? And in that case, I probably would, or I would ask everybody else, hey, can we start half an hour later because so-and-so is getting off work late? But if you're talking about changing the time from, like, 7 p.m. to, like, 3:30 p.m., that's a much huger change, and that might not work, right? So I, for one person, probably not, but would you bump the session back half an hour, the start time back half an hour? I probably would. So it just depends. As far as the second part of Daniel's answer to MW's question. That what that question was is what you, is your DM alignment? And the basic idea here is that not good and evil in the real world sense, but the idea that a good DM is one that roots for the players and looks for every way to keep a player alive, you know, any kind of rules loophole they can use to keep that player alive if they go under zero hit points or whatever. It, where an evil DM is one of those that sets up the traps, you know, intentionally to try to catch the players and mistakes to kill them, which does sound bad when I say it that way. And then the other part of that idea is lawful and chaotic. The idea of lawful DM is one that follows the rules as written as best they can and wants to use all the rules in the book or wants to use the rules as they're written in the book, where a chaotic DM is one that does a lot of homebrew and a lot of house rules to their game. So those aren't definitions I came up with. Those are the ones, I'm not sure where they came from, but MW mentioned that on one of those episodes. So that's where those questions come from. And Riley from Diegetic Advancement, another great podcast, is going to also answer those questions later in this episode. But before we hear Riley's answers, Daniel has a little bit more to say.
What was the other thing? There was one other thing. Oh, large parties. You know, I don't know that, and again, different people had different ways of playing. But I don't know, this whole, like, people used to play the role and now they're actors thing is at all accurate. It's 100% not accurate. In our case, we totally played characters. We didn't play with large groups. We didn't play the thief. We played our characters that had very distinct backgrounds. And we spent hours drawing pictures of them and establishing, like, you know, buying cool, like, saddles for their horses and equipping them and getting, you know, castles and hideaways. And we played those characters. We played them as characters and we treated them that way. The idea of having to have a lot of people in the group, I think, is also somewhat false. And I guess people that play these games come at me and tell me I'm wrong, but I don't think that everybody sitting around their house in the 70s and 80s were playing with 20 and 30 people in large campaigns with seven people at a time. I think that modules say that because modules were initially made as something to be played at tournaments, I think was the word. So, yeah, you know, those modules were made for 10 characters because they were trying to fill the tournaments. And then once that became the structure, people played that way. I also don't think that people stopped using henchmen because the game changed. I think the game changed because people stopped using henchmen. You know, as much as we can look at a game or incarnation of a game, whether it be second edition or third edition or fourth edition or even AD&D versus OD&D, things didn't change because they just decided, oh, this is what we want to do. They looked at how people played and they adjusted the game, right? Maybe OD&D intended that people would become lords and rule castles at 10th level and they wouldn't go further, but people played higher levels. So TSR gave them what they wanted, higher level potential, more high level spells, you know, adventures into higher levels, because that's what people were playing. Like, the game will shift to what the players do. It doesn't usually work the other way around, in my opinion. So, but I would love to hear what other people say about that. So in short, awesome episode. Really cool. I think Riverside works pretty well. Those are my thoughts. I'm really curious what people have to say about the various things, especially the groups. I think that's such an interesting, it's one of those things like one-to-one time, which I won't bring that wrath down onto your podcast, that people just bring up, like, they have this authority that, like, everybody did something this way and this is the way it is. And guess what? Not everybody is the same. People play differently now. People play different, you know, different groups, I mean, and people play differently then. It's just the way it was. It's the way it is. It's a game. We all make it our own. That's what makes the game great. Anyways, have a great day. That's a super long message. I'll talk to you later.
Daniel, thank you again for all these thoughts and for the, Daniel's going to have another call here later on. But to hit those points really quickly, the last set of points, I agree. You know, we played individual characters. We didn't play the thief and the cleric. We played, you know, whatever name they were and with personalities and all that. And I think we see that back to the beginning of the hobby. You know, when you read the play reports of Gary Sessions, he's not playing a magic user, right? He's they're all named and they have personalities. And so I do agree with that. As far as large groups go, yeah, no, you're not wrong. I mean, when we were playing as kids, we were playing in small groups, although we had henchmen, and which made them bigger groups. I don't know if your group used henchmen and all that, hirelings and all, we did. But, you know, when I got back in the hobby, we were playing in large groups of 7, 8, 10 people. And I personally really enjoy playing with large groups of people. But I think your point about the game didn't change, but the hobby changed is probably right. I don't think you're wrong in the idea that when they moved away from the idea of needing higher parties and moved away from domain play and moved away from having large numbers of hirelings and henchmen, that wasn't TSR saying we hate these things or WotC saying we hate these things. That was them reacting to what feedback they were getting from the players. And I think that probably is true. I think the gaming culture itself changed. And we know there was different play styles from the very beginning of the hobby. There's never been a unified play style after the game was out in the hands of customers, right? And we see that back to the earliest fanzines and the earliest newsletters and letters into wargaming newsletters and stuff, the arguments about play styles. So it's always been there. Just like large groups have always been there, just because I don't know what percentage of games were played in people's basements. Those were, but you know, some of those were small and some of those were large. We know Kevin over at Palladium Books, you know, I talked about that interview with him earlier when he was running a Detroit Games Center. He, you know, he had a dozen, 20 players at a time. When you look at some of the games that Gygax ran in them, not just at conventions, but look at like Arduin and look at these things, you know, when you had these big groups of people's houses, they were playing in big groups at times, right? So, but it's interesting that we don't hear so much about those big groups today. They're still out there. We know they're still out there. Vic Dorso still runs large games with large groups every week. They're in Minnesota. So we know this happens regularly, but on a percentage basis, yeah, in the overall scheme of things, most were probably 3 or 4 players or 4 to 6 players, and then maybe a bunch of hirelings at first, and maybe it whittled down to just 4 to 6 players. I don't know. People would have to call in with their personal experiences, especially I'd be interested in people's experiences in the 70s and early 80s. Okay, let's go to that call from Riley that I talked about earlier.
Hey, Jason. Riley here. I listened to the Monsters and Treasures podcast the other day, and they were talking about looking up the rules during play. Cow's advice was just to call in to your show for any AD&D rules. So I'm just at the table now with my players and hoping you can get back to us soon. How many arrows can the ranger shoot in a surprise segment?
First of all, I want to say that I am not the expert on AD&D First Edition. KR has done everyone a huge disservice. I am a student of the game. I love the game. I've loved the game since the early 80s when I picked it up. But I am still learning AD&D First Edition like everyone else is. There are others that are much more qualified than I to answer these questions. But this actually is a fairly easy question because you asked about how many arrows a ranger can fire in a surprise segment. And I heard the word segment ending with T, which is a single surprise segment. So with a single surprise segment, the fact he's a ranger is irrelevant. And when we look in the rules, this is in the DMG on page 62, we see that the discharge of arrows, bolts, or hand-hurled weapons is permissible at 3 times normal rate, providing the weapon missiles are ready, otherwise normal rates for rounds. And that is for a surprise segment. So if the bow and the arrows are readied, which most people, not most people, a lot of people will judge as like the arrows are already stuck in the ground, ready to be grabbed out, that kind of thing. You know, it's a set ambush. Then they would be able to fire at 3 times the normal rate that particular ranger can fire. So How many arrows can your ranger fire in a single normal combat round? Well, they can fire 3 times that rate if the arrows and the weapon are ready during a surprise segment. That is the answer. I don't know if you used Unearthed Arcana, so those will determine how many you could fire during a normal round. But whatever the answer to that is, 3 times that is the number of readied arrows they could fire during a surprise segment. But again, you as the DM are going to have to determine what readied means. And like I say, a lot of people determine that is in like they're already stuck in the ground, ready to be grabbed out, stuff like that. So that's a determination you're going to have to make. But if you determine they are readied, then 3 times the normal rate is the answer to your question.
Okay, on to the actual call. Thanks for checking out Riverside for us. I'll be sticking to a recorder app on my phone and Audacity. I can't imagine editing on my phone anyway. I'm not even old, and my fingers and eyes just aren't up to the task. Really liked hearing from MW, great co-host as always. I'm not sure what type of GM I am. It's likely game dependent, though I can't see a case for being an evil GM. Maybe a lawful evil GM would be fun in a one-shot, two Mahoras-like game. I know neutral was banned, but lawful neutral, lawful good seems to me make for a good, strict, old-school game, whereas chaotic neutral sounds perfect for more like a story game. And finally, I'll answer the actual question you pose. You said it's highly dependent on the group. Sorry, this is in relation to when should you reschedule or cancel a game for, you know, should you do it for one player? As you say, highly dependent on the group, but my preference would be to never move the date, never cancel. Ideally, even when the game master can't make it, someone else picks up a backup game. Scheduling is the biggest killer of groups in my experience, and I really, really hate setting time aside for something to then have it cancelled or moved because one or two players can't make it. I'd rather rock up, run a duet session, then cancel or reschedule. Of course, there are exceptions, but that's my default take. Anyway, thanks for the show. Talk to you later.
Riley, thank you for answering those questions from MW. Anybody else that wants to answer those questions, what DM alignment are you, and would you change the timing or the date of a session for just one player? Please call in. I would love to hear those answers. I have changed sessions for one player in the past. I definitely have. And often I've been the player that's asked for a session to be changed. So I can appreciate that because often I'm the person that's the problem. but regardless, I appreciate everybody's answers for that. And I think Riley really nailed on the head. If possible, still do something with your group. This is something that Che over at Roleplay Rescue's talked about a lot. You need that consistency. So even if you're not going to play a game, still get online and do a hangout session. If you have an in-person group, break out a board game. But the idea of doing a duet role-playing game is not a bad one. What Carl over at the Gemologist Presents has done a lot is switch to a backup game. So Carl will have his main game, and then maybe they'll have Hyperborea as a backup game, and if he just has two players show up, they'll play in Hyperborea that day instead. So that's another great strategy. Have a game that works with just one or two players, and that just gets switched in on those dates that you have a smaller group. Okay, now we're going to go to that call from Merc, Merc the Meek, another great podcast we talked about earlier in the show. Merc has a question about what rule set to use, and I reached out and got some answers from Merc from some people with some experience with these different rule sets. So I'm going to let you hear Merc's question first, and then the answers are going to be from EOTB, Daniel, and Minion.
Hey, this is Merc. I just got done listening to your latest call-in episode and wanted to call in. The Badly Dead game sounds interesting. It reminds me of a cool mini or not game called Masmora, which is semi-related to the Arcadia Quest line of things. You have custom dice in that you roll. They have swords and shields and magic icons and movement icons, and you assign those after the fact. But still kind of fun. You have different classes of characters, and they interact with those dice in different ways. So, interesting dungeon crawler as well. I will second Joe's suggestion of Dale Kingsmill. She does a lot of 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons stuff, which is fine. But she does a lot of great mythology stuff, or she did. I would love for her to do some more. I guess my main thought, though, is with the discussion about AD&D and how it's like organized and everything, and recently a conversation on Audio Dungeon Discord about BX, what's written in there versus what's in Old School Essentials. I'm just wondering, would it be better to just purchase Osric or Old School Essentials if you haven't really purchased or you don't have physical copies of the originals, you know, the AD&D, Player's Guide, DMG, etc., or BX? Because you've got all those lessons learned that, you know, Daniel was talking about when it comes to like what's in Unearthed Arcana and Dragon magazine articles after the physical products of AD&D were already made. You know, these newer things have the ability to look back, put the lessons that are learned into the new products and organize them better. So would EOTB, would Daniel, would, you know, you guys that are AD&Ders, would you recommend somebody getting Osric or Old School Essentials over the originals for organization reasons? Now, there could be, you know, reasons for like wanting to look back at the historical documents. There could be reasons for nostalgia, but I don't really have nostalgia for those books. Are the newer ones superior in the fact that they're more organized and more clear, I guess is my question. I'm curious to hear everyone's answers on that. So, yeah, once again, you have a great podcast. Keep up the good work and take care.
Hey, Jason, this is EOTB with an answer for Merck's question regarding whether or not Osric, for example, would be a better product for someone who wanted to get into AD&D to get instead of the original books. And at a high level, for most people, my answer would be yes. That's a qualified answer, so I'll explain. When Osric came out, it was not intending to be used instead of AD&D. It was intended to be a publisher's resource so that people could publish new adventures, new settings, with the assumption that those would be used at the table by people who were using the AD&D books to actually run the game. So at a high level, what this means is that the Osric books cover most everything out of the player's handbook. I'm trying to think if there's anything in the player's handbook that really isn't touched, except for maybe a few bits like the monk and the bard that were not touched because of how conservative they were in their new use of the OGL that had never been tried before. But player's handbook, almost everything in there is going to be in Osric. The monster manual, once again, excepting a few monsters that, you know, were not in the SRD and were not available in other OGL products, such as the monster book put out by Frog God, that's going to be pretty much in there. The DMG is very selective, however, because you did not need to know how weapon speed worked in first edition to write a module. So things like that are not in Osric. So if someone is just looking to understand the basics of AD&D, like how does combat work in general? What's the trunk line of AD&D on how to play it? Osric, yes, is going to be able to get you up to speed on that much, much earlier. If someone is very interested in all of the nuances of first edition and they want to see how a game runs with all of those nuances folded in, then you will eventually have to supplement that with the first edition DMG. And obviously, if you had a player who wanted to play a monk, you would have to have the first edition player's handbook, etc. So what I tell people is absolutely yes. If you are brand new to the game, grab Osric. The Black Blade edition of Osric, I think, is still like $30, and that's an offset print book of hundreds of pages. I mean, you'll pay more for a bundle of zines than you will for that book, and it's a gorgeous book. So my recommendation for everyone is absolutely, if you're new to the game, get Osric first, read through it, play that player's handbook plus monster manual plus smidgens of DMG material to get the core gameplay loop down. And then after you are very good with that, start folding in stuff from the DMG and just be aware that it's there and that you'll need to. I have also heard anecdotally from people who did the Osric first approach that it was easier for them to understand the bits in the DMG that were not in Osric when they weren't having to understand those bits while they were also trying to learn the main trunk line of the game through Gygaxian prose. So, you know, DM, grab that Blackblade book. You can get it by contacting Blackblade on Facebook. I think they're setting up a web store, but for years they've just run it through emails. You know, you email Taco John, and he ships a book back to you. Also, the Player's Guide was recently released by Charlie, the guy who did FMAG, and that's up on Amazon. That's $8. So you can get the first three chapters of Osric, which is all the player-facing stuff, all the classes, all the spells, etc., for $8 off of Amazon print as table copies. Absolutely, very much recommend it. Just be aware that you will need to go out and grab the DMG for those little bits. Have a good one.
EOTB, thank you so much for that call and that response. I really appreciate it, helping Merc out there. So, folks, you can find more from EOTB on the Classic Adventure Game podcast. EOTB is also on the Classic Adventure Game Discord and the Swords and Wizardry Discord, as well as a number of other Discords. So, and, you know, not that EOTB needs me to back their credentials up at all, but EOTB is also very heavily into doing the background stuff to build Osric, so essentially AD&D First Edition, in the Foundry Virtual Tabletop with the Advanced Role-Playing System, the ARS framework for Foundry, you know, which effectively is built off of Osric. So EOTB has pretty extensive knowledge of Osric and of AD&D First Edition to pull from for that answer. Now we're going to go on to two other podcasters who don't need nearly that introduction and background. And that's, the first call is from Daniel of the Bandits Keep Media Empire. And then I'm just going to let that one roll into the second call from Minion of Confessions of Wee Timorous Bushi. And because this episode is already getting very long, after Minion's call, we're just going to go right into the end credits, the end song by TJ. So I want to thank all my callers. I want to thank everybody that helped answer this question and everybody that called in about all the other things. I want to thank, again, TJ for the wonderful music, Ray Otis for the coffee cup clip art, and I'll ask everybody to be excellent to each other. Now I'm going to turn it over to Daniel Minion for their answers. And remember, after the ending music, I'm going to be giving my spoiler-filled review of True Detective Season 4, which I recorded directly after watching the final episode. So if you're interested in that, stay after the final music. If you're not interested in hearing about True Detective Season 4, then when the ending music comes on, turn off the show.
Hey Jason, I'm responding to Merc's question. I will try to keep it brief. So I'm going to break it down into two categories here, because I'm definitely much more of a BX person than an AD&D person. So my thought with BX versus OSC is that OSC is something that I would get as a reference, but I would 100% recommend BX. If you were trying to get into the old school, you were learning how to play, and you came from no game or you came from 5e, I think BX is a superior entry point because it teaches you how to play the game. Now, I know Merc said just organization, but I think that that is key. If I just hand you the game and say, this is better organized, so you should have this instead, and you don't understand how to play, you don't get the feeling of it, then you're not going to get the full experience. So I think that that's that. Now, is OSE better organized? I think that's questionable. I think the fact that it's in one book makes it better organized, but if you are familiar with BX, it is not hard to find anything in that book. I don't have trouble finding it. I have OSE. I have BX. I use the OSE PDF when I run online, simply so I can have one file open. But when I'm playing in person or if I'm using my books, I use my BX books all the time. So I don't use the OSE book. I actually find how small it is, but also how fat it is, to be a little bit aggravating. So personally, for me at the table, I actually like the size of the BX books. So I like to use those physically. So I guess to answer that part of it, I would take BX over OSE if you had to choose. But in an ideal world, you'd get physicals or buy PDFs and print BX and then get the OSE PDF if you're running online just for quick reference.
Osric's a little bit different. So my history with Osric, and I do have a physical book of it. I bought it right when the OGL thing broke, and I thought maybe they were going to maybe pull it. So when I first got back into playing, one of the first things I played was AD&D, and I had the player's handbook, and I was looking something up. I was playing online, and somebody recommended Osric. They sent me a link. I think it was a free PDF at that time. It probably still is. And I know there's different versions of Osric. And honestly, when I looked at it, it felt really stale. But I think that stale, I don't know if that's the right word. It felt overly processed. I don't know the best way to say it, especially having started to look at the player's handbook and having that nostalgia. So I think that to me, I bounced off of it a little bit. I would probably not pick up Osric over AD&D because, again, maybe more for a nostalgia reason. However, I think there's more to it because looking back at some of the reasons why I like BX over OSC, I wonder by stripping back the rules so much and taking out so much of the flavor, if you do lose a little bit of the author's intent. And you may say you don't care what the author's intent was, you just want a rule set. But I don't know, I like to have the author's intent. I don't want a dry rule set. It's one of the reasons why I don't love super, super minimal RPGs that have become the thing lately, where it's like one page and it's just a bunch of tables. To me, that doesn't tell you anything. If you look at a simple, now here's the opposite. Now I'm going to linger here. Into the Odd would be the perfect example of a simple rule set that has tons of flavor. Whereas, I'm not going to name one that's not, but basically there's lots of games. Maze Rats would be come to mind. That's just a bunch of tables. And you could say that's amazing and Maze Rats is an amazing resource. But again, how do we play Maze Rats? It's just a bunch of tables. Into the Odd, you get a feel for the game. I think this is the same situation. With AD&D, I want those books. I want to know what the game was kind of inspired, what inspired them to make the game, what it's supposed to feel like. And I will stumble through some awkward formatting if people believe that's what it is. You know, again, I think Osric is a reference book. It's even in the name. And OSE Rules Tome is a reference book. So yes, they are better organized for reference. But if I could only choose one, I would definitely take the originals, not because of nostalgia, but because I think that the flavor that comes with the game is more important to me than being able to pinpoint an exact spot of an obscure rule at the table in a moment's notice. I would rather just make a ruling, look it up later, or stop the game if you feel like looking through the books. I mean, it's not a big deal. Anyways, that's a great question. I'm curious what other people say, especially about AD&D, which is certainly my blind spot. I don't really have a lot of real good experience as an adult with AD&D. Like I said before in other call-ins, I've probably run maybe a dozen or a little more than that games, played in a few, but it's definitely not something I'm super versed in. BX, I've run hundreds of sessions, so I can firmly say BX is easy to navigate. Sorry, said that three times. Easy to navigate, simple to play. And frankly, once you've run BX like about a half dozen times, you probably don't look at the rule books at all, except for your monsters. So, yeah, maybe you have to remember which book the monster's in, but that's not really a big deal.
Okay, thank you, Merc, for this question. An absolutely amazing question, I think. A really important question. And also thank you for Jason to reaching out and including me in this conversation. All right, very simple answer first. Yes, I think Osric, I think Old School Essentials, and I think some of the other clones that we'll go into shortly are worth propagandizing and propagating and getting people playing. Evangelizing, is that the word? Evangelizing, oh, that's horrible, isn't it? And I'll say why I think that in a moment. First, I think we have to be clear. We divide these games, these old school games, into three parts at least. Okay, so we're going to talk about, maybe we're talking about original Dungeons & Dragons, OD&D, which is roughly 1974 to 1977. And then remembering also that that OD&D phase is split between the 74 game, which had only three classes. It didn't have the thief. And the 75 onwards game, which slowly began to morph into something closer to advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And we see that in AD&D, in first edition AD&D, to a lesser degree in the second edition of AD&D, we see the game is an outgrowth of that OD&D phase. And that is part of the reason for its continued obscurity. That's not the right word, is it? Perhaps it is. Its continued esoteric nature, its confusions, its lack of clarity, right? It's like a tree that's kept on growing, and it has these deformities, these little kind of bowls in it, and strange shapes that are based on how it grew as a seedling, right? And that's got a lot of character, as you say. But throwing aside the history, throwing aside the nostalgia, if we're coming to the game as either newbies or as people who are unfamiliar but interested in the older type of game, the more stripped type down type of game, yes, Osric, etc. are interesting. Okay, so now we've probably got to look at the games that I'm talking about. So if we're looking at OD&D 1974, roughly, I would point people in the direction of White Box Fantasy Adventure Game, I think it's called, and it doesn't use the word RPG, which I think is fantastic. Medieval Fantasy Adventure Game, something like that. It is such a stripped-down rule that I've seen people refer to it as an incomplete game, but it's not. It is very much OD&D, but so cleared up and cleaned up. If you don't know about role-playing games, again, it's not an intro to role-playing games. So, you know, you've got to remember these games aren't exactly intros to role-playing games. And there's other games for that. There's other systems that might be better to walk into if you want to learn about role-playing games. But just strictly speaking about role-players who want to learn or play the older editions, that's a great game. It is very stripped back, and it's going to play out very, very differently from anything else out there, including another OD&D so-called retro clone, which is Iron Falcon. I'm not going to talk about Swords and Wizardry. That's another great one in a similar phase of D&D development, but Iron Falcon is closer to the original rules. So Iron Falcon, what is it? Has the four classes. It's based loosely on 1975 D&D, which is the White Box Plus, the Greyhawk supplement. So you've got a little bit of you've got the thief in there. You've got a little bit of paladin. It stays very close to the original rules. There's some talk about adding in certain rules, or what kind of rules did Gary play? What kind of rules does the game creator play? What kind of rules were people playing at the time? There's options there at the end, and you can tick little boxes and blah, 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 right? It's fairly straightforward. It's starting to look a little bit closer to AD&D or Osric, but it's still very focused. It's a little bit more focused. And interesting point, the modifiers of OD&D, which are just pretty much a plus or plus one or a zero or a minus one, not a great deal of variation from the 3 to the 18 levels, right, range. Here we've got a little bit more range, you know, 18s do matter, 3s do matter, but it's still kept within tight margins, let's say. And it doesn't really penalise people for having lower scores, particularly in dexterity and constitution. So I've got a character that I'm playing in, Iron Falcon. It's got a constitution. It has a constitution of 7. No penalty to hit points. Look, hit points are already low anyway. I think that's a really great design point. And that comes from the original Greyhawk version of D&D. So, you know, really tiny little differences, but meaningful differences. All right, we'll move up now to AD&D, which is, I think, really what the talk is focusing on. But I've got to come back to BX, haven't I? Because I've not really talked about old school essentials. AD&D, Osric is not as close a clone, a retro clone of AD&D as, say, Iron Falcon or Old School Essentials is to BX. But Osric is brilliant because AD&D implies or demands that you know a little bit about D&D. You've learned it at the table, so you've got some kind of mentor, somebody you've been playing with that's passed on the knowledge, their knowledge to you. Or you've come from Holmes Basic, or you've come from the BX or Beckme, you know, Basic D&D, etc. You've come from original D&D. That's the basis of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. It is not a complete game. It is the advanced reference rules, and it says that very specifically on the first page. It is a full game if you understand how it's played, but it's not described fully within those rules, okay? And it jumps around and it has inconsistencies because it was written between 77 and 79 over a 2-year period. Right, Osric. Why is Osric good? Because it takes the core of that game and it presents the rules in a concise and consistent manner. The modifiers for ability scores aren't exactly the same as what you'll find in AD&D, nor are the thief skills, etc. So they have been changed somewhat. What do you have? You have a game that roughly follows the description of the rules in the original Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide, etc. But it's arranged in a way that it gets rid of certain factors. It gets rid of the jumpy nature of the rules as presented in the original DMG, for example. It's not exactly the same, but it presents it in a way that is the same in spirit, okay? It is AD&D in spirit, 100% in my opinion. Now, that's an issue that a lot of maybe advanced Dungeons & Dragons players are really... I would say I'm probably a hardcore AD&D player. I think Osric is excellent, and it should be more than what it's presented as, which is rules to make the game accessible when AD&D was out of print, or rules to enable the publishing of modules. No, I disagree with that. I think Osric is deserving of a lot more love than it gets. It plays very well at the table, and it has really helped. I think it really helps people grok the rules. Okay, that's a massive topic. I'm running out of time. This isn't my podcast. Old School Essentials is a brilliant game. Again, it's looking at a slightly different game. You know, the 1981, let's say, rules of basic and expert Dungeons and Dragons, as you probably know. It is very close to the original rules. It drops certain important things, such as examples of play. And now, these examples of play, people like Daniel of Bandit's Keep and others will say that the examples are actually probably the most important part of the rules. I suspect Jason would say the same thing, and they are not wrong in that. But we'll come back to that. Old School Essentials is BX D&D. It is BX D&D. Not in presentation, but in rules it is. In content it is. And where there are slight differences or interpretations of the rules which were unclear in the original rules, the guy who designed it, Mr. Norman, is that right? Norman. He says what he's doing. So a very similar approach to Chris Goneman in Iron Falcon. He describes what he's doing and he says where he's diverging from the rules and why he's done it. But he only does that where necessary. Old School Essentials, it's a brilliant game. The procedural nature of the rules in some places puts people off. It shouldn't. The procedural nature there is to makes the rules vary, run very smooth. So by the time that you play these procedures through so many times, they become second nature, so that they kind of disappear into the background, and they become a framework that allows you to build on top of it, right? So it doesn't become this artificial framework. It becomes something that is very intuitive and smooth, and creates a very hard core, a very hard, a very firm structure on which to throw everything. Okay, it's brilliant, and everything has that structure, from adventuring to combat to whatever. So it allows you to look at the way that time plays out in the game and space plays out in the game, and arrive at very very good determinations in the game, and hopefully ones that are understandable by the players as well. Right, where does OSE differ? It has advanced rules, right? And you're saying, well, so what's the difference? Well, it has advanced rules that allow you to incorporate elements of AD&D into the BX game, but it's still at its heart the BX game. Some of the rules start moving towards, they're edging towards AD&D, but it still has a kind of balance, a sort of framework in mind that is essentially BX. To return to conclude, these games are wonderful in my opinion. They are doorways to the older style games. They bring in slightly different ways of doing the game, such as ascending armor class instead of the descending armor class, which is easier for some people to grasp, as is having, you know, combat bonuses, like a plus one, which is kind of like your proficiency bonus or whatever. For some people, that's better than having tables. Yeah, these tables need to be referred to, right? If you've got some kind of mathematics that allows you to do it in your head, including Thaco, but that's not necessary in old school essentials, etc., then these are little useful little tools. The thing it's missing, these games frequently miss, but not always, but usually, are the examples, the game examples. How do the rules play out at the table? This can be gotten at from buying a copy as a DM, buying a copy of the basic or the expert rules, by buying a copy of the Dungeon Master's Guide, and then retroactively, if you like, referring to those original games to derive examples of play and interpretations of rules that aren't obvious in the newer so-called retro clones. So that's a very long answer, but hopefully it's of some use. This will overlap perhaps with some of the other people that you've asked in some ways. And in some ways, maybe it will conflict with what they're saying. And that's natural. There's always going to be a slight conflict in a different interpretation. And you will have your own conflicts, and other players will have their own interpretations. And so that's a great thing. That's a natural thing, to have a difference in view, to look at those views, to look at the sources, and then arrive at what works best at your table. And probably most people won't argue with that point there. So amazing question. Thank you so much, Merc. Thanks, Jason. And thank you to everybody else who's responding to this. And I look forward to hearing to the other responses as well. Bye-bye.
And remember, folks, if you sent a call in to Jason and you haven't heard it on this episode, have no fear. It will appear.
Joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's
What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I better shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. I want some more, bring on the gore. Well, the butcher is a dustman and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away. Rising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.
Okay, everything from here on out are spoilers for True Detective Season 4, Night Country. So I'm assuming that you have watched the show, watched the season, and are okay with hearing spoilers about it. Overall, I'm a little bit disappointed. It was okay. It was fine. It's, I think, the weakest of the four seasons. I think there's some strong performances in here, and I, for the most part, do like the cast, and I think there's some amazing things in the story and some great things that could be pulled out of here, but overall, I think it is lacking a little bit. I think the intentional ties to the first season were a little bit weak, honestly. Having Rusty Cole, Matthew McConaughey's father, in there is Travis Cole, is the, I think his name was Travis, but anyway, is the ghost in the first episode that Rose sees that points her to the bodies. I don't think you needed that. I think that was kind of super duper heavy-handed, honestly. Having the overall corporation or the overall funding coming from the Tuttle Corporation was subtler, and I was okay with that. The spiral is fine, although it how much it really played into here, who knows. But I was fine with that too. And I could even get by with the reference to time as a flat circle if you wanted. Although, again, it's a little bit heavy-handed the way that came out. But, yeah, I think using Rusty Cole's dad the way they did was a misstep. I think by only being six episodes, this season was hindered a little bit. They had to do a lot in those six episodes, so we got less detective work. We got less of the actual investigation. And I don't mind the personal bits and the views into these people's lives and all that, because that's a normal part of True Detective in these other seasons. So I do want to see those personal stories, but I would like to see some more of the detective parts as well. So I think the shortened season hurt it a little bit. And I really dislike two things. One, the overt supernatural aspects. The supernatural was alluded to in the first season, but that could have been just mental illness of Rusty Cole. Where here, it's much more overt, and you're really led to believe it, the supernatural is happening there. The dead are walking, and the one-eyed polar bear, and spirit animals, and all the different things. And I'm not against that in a show, but I don't know if it fits in a neo-noir detective show, right? It's kind of into something else now. I think if this was just The Night Country, not True Detective The Night Country, it would have been a little more palatable. It didn't ruin it for me, by any means. It's not the thing I hate the most about the show, and hate's a strong word. It's not the thing I dislike the most about the show, but I do dislike the overt supernatural, the attempts at jump scares, things like that. I don't think that was needed, honestly. It's HBO, so you're going to have sex scenes. I think all the seasons did. I don't remember if the third season did or not now. But whatever. That's what they do. That doesn't bother me. The thing I disliked the most, honestly, was the ending. I think the ending was too nice. It was too wrapped up. It was too neat. And it was too happy. even in season one, where we kind of win, right? You know, Woody Harrelson and Rusty Cole, well, and Matthew McConaughey, I forget Woody Harrelson's name, character's name, but they're in a bad place. You know, they've lost their families, separated out. They're, you know, living these shells of what their lives could have been. And they won this small battle. But as Woody Harrelson's character says at the end, you know, darkness has a whole, the dark has a lot more territory, right? Than light does. So I don't know. I think the ending was too happy. I think young Pryor getting back with his family was a misstep. I think that family break should have happened to be true to what we've seen in the series before with the other seasons. I think his, you know, that should have been it. He should have been broken at that point. His family should have been separated. How do you go back to work and have a normal life after killing your father, right? Especially in that manner. I don't know. I mean, you could, I guess. I mean, it's not like his... you know, he stopped his father from killing, you know, the chief. But still, that was rough. Not having Navarro walk into the ice, I think, was a mistake. I don't know. And I think Danvers still being the police chief, I think she probably shouldn't be the police chief. I just think the ending was too wrapped up, too happy for everybody. I would have been fine with it being happy for the, you know, for the indigenous folk, the Inuit, I don't know the right word right now, and I should look it up. I apologize to everybody. But for the ladies in there that were the cleaning staff and, you know, the locals, I was okay with the ending they had. That didn't bother me. But I think our principals should have had a more broken ending. I'm okay with Navarro surviving, but I don't think everybody should have got a happy ending. And your three main characters in this season, you know, all get happy endings, happy-ish endings, right? And I think that's a misstep. That's the biggest misstep for me. The casting, I think, was really good. You know, let's go to positives. The casting was excellent, I think. I really liked who they had. I really like what they did. You know, female-led cast is not an issue. I think everybody gave it their all. I think we had some really, really good performances across the board. The casting was a strong point for this season. I think the setting was a really strong point. This is somewhere different. You know, each of these seasons, well, that's not true. Season three kind of ties in with season one closer. But, you know, the different location I think was smart. I think having it in that nighttime, you know, constant night was excellent. You know, the ice caves were creepy as hell. I think you could do a lot with this. I really liked the setting. I just think the season was hurt by being too short, by the overt supernatural aspects and the happy ending, happy-ish ending. I think those were the missteps here. And trying too hard to tie it to season one, I think, was also a mistake. I understand why, right? Even season three tried to tie back to season one a little bit because of the pushback against season two. You know, season two suffered the same problem that Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, had. Because Halloween 3, nobody liked it because Michael Myers wasn't in it. And Halloween 3 is one, you know, is a great movie, but that's what John Carpenter wanted. He wanted to do an anthology. He wanted to do different movies under the Halloween name, but he didn't necessarily need them to be tied together. Well, that was the view here for True Detective. And what they always wanted to do was tell these neo-noir detective stories, but they weren't necessarily going to be connected together. But when season two came out and people are like, well, this isn't season one. We don't have Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, and we don't have Carcosa and the Yellow King. Everybody shit on season two, but season two is actually a pretty good story. It's, you know, it's a depressing is not the right word. It's a neo-noir story, right? That's not really a happy ending. They're, you know, their survivors are on a run at the end of season two. You know, you try to fight the man and the man wins in season two. season two, I think, is very underrated, to be honest. I think there's some really good acting in that season. And I think it's a well-done season. Same with season three. Season three, so if I had to rank True Detective, I would go season one, season three, season two, season four. And season four isn't because of the performances. That's not why it's last. It's last because of the happy ending and the overt supernatural and the fact that it's not season four's fault, but the fact it's only six episodes and it's cut back meant they had to cut things out, and I think that hurt it quite a bit. I don't know. I need to rewatch. I've only seen season two and three and four one time each. I've seen season one multiple times. I probably need to watch season two and three again, but I want to say it's season three and then season two in my ranking. That could switch, but those two are in the middle. And I think the longer seasons helped flesh those out, made them feel real. There's really good acting in all these, though. I don't think that you make a mistake by watching this. If you're listening to the spoiler-filled thing and you haven't watched it, I've spoiled a couple things here, obviously. But I still think it's a pretty strong season. I think there's good acting in here, good performances. I think it's worth watching. I think the setting is great. And I think there's some really great things that they brought into this. I just think, you know, is it due to money? Is it due to whatever? I just think the shortened season, the overt supernatural aspects, and the happy ending, you know, really bring it down. Which is a shame because I really do enjoy the performances and the setting of this story. So that's my thoughts on True Detective Season 4. I'd be happy to hear anybody else's thoughts. If you do call in or you want to talk about this, we can do that on the show. All the talk about this will be after the end credits like this is, because I want other people to be able to hear the show without hearing spoilers. Again, I appreciate your time, and I'm curious what your thoughts are, and I will talk to you later. Be excellent to each other.